The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better. Did you know that championship tennis players, you know, elite professional athletes, underperform when they can see a tournament's trophy displayed on the court? It makes sense, right? When you're really fixated and worried about an outcome, your brain loses track of the present, right? You go a million miles ahead, you start worrying, you start trying to control, you get anxious. And maybe don't stay in the moment, which is, of course, where your great play happens. My guest today, author Maggie Jackson, unpacks very, very typical, common, everyday instances of when our human brains get mired in fear of uncertainty, how it trips us up, and how, using the latest in neuroscience, we can move forward. I love Maggie's book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsured. I'm not alone. It's been nominated for a National Book Award and named a top 10 social sciences book of 2023 by Library Journal. Maggie has a very helpful and human approach towards taking us out of anxiety and learning to flex the muscles and the wonder and the skill that comes with when we embrace uncertainty and move through it. I swear it has literally changed how I approach uncertainty in the moment. And yes, that is scientifically proven to work. If you're in a moment where you're really uncertain and you feel anxiety coming in, give yourself a cue word. Tell yourself, I'm in the game. I'm in the game. Stay in the here and now. And your body, your physiology will change. So I hope you find this conversation as valuable as I have. And I welcome your thoughts on how you're thinking about uncertainty in these extremely uncertain times. I think that there has been, my own work included, a lot of conversation in the past recent years about the fact that difficult emotions like anxiety aren't bad, right? They aren't bad or good. They're realities, they're emotions. We need to learn to manage them. You're talking about sort of embracing uncertainty and actually thriving in it, which feels at a very human level like such a counterintuitive idea. Why do we need to do this? What sparked this?
Yes, and that's such a great point too, that, you know, when we're talking about it, when I talk about embracing uncertainty, I'm not saying, for instance, that uncertainty should be limitless or that all depths of uncertainty are what we need. You know, we don't want to wallow in it. It's not the end goal. But, you know, evidence suggests that we live in an increasingly certainty-seeking culture. It's really time to hold it up to the light and then realize that we've very much misunderstood this state of mind. So it's very important not only to tap into the curiosity, the wonder, the exploratory nature of life itself and what we're doing at work, but it's also really important on a larger scale. For instance, uncertainty skillfully managed can really actually offer some answers to the polarization that divides us. It very much can help people liberate themselves. It's not a cure-all, but yet it can help people liberate themselves from the incredible stress and anxiety, as you talk about so well, at work. It can be an antidote to the narrow-mindedness that we see closing in on us in so many different ways. So I think we have both personal and also larger cultural issues at stake in, you know, reimagining and updating our understanding of uncertainty.
You wrote in the New York Times that our uneasy sense of not knowing triggers a host of beneficial neural changes, including heightened attention, bolstered working memory, and sensitivity to new information. And you really dive into the brain science behind why embracing uncertainty can be beneficial. And yet you sort of talk about the accepted belief that anxiety equals fear of the unknown in our common parlance. Can you talk more about that? Like why we've come to sort of equate anxiety with fear of the unknown?
Yes. And I think it's a great starting point to basically start off with the unease and the angst that uncertainty gives us, because that's actually natural. I mean, we as organisms or, you know, humans are built to seek and need answers. We need to operate that way. It's really important to understand, however, that unease is not the same or doesn't have to be the same as a negative, you know, static inertia or weakness, what have you. So the discomfort of uncertainty is related to a stress response that you have when you meet up with something new, unexpected, ambiguous. You know, it could be a traffic jam when you're late, or it could be a new memo from the boss, et cetera, or even just, you know, your child wakes up and they're kind of sick, but you're not really sure. This doesn't look like the normal cold. So when we meet something new in those circumstances, you know, the body and brain kind of spring into alertness. And the neuroscience that you were talking about, the, you know, working memory and in fact, the broadened attention scientists sometimes call curious eyes, which is really interesting. That all is a kind of wakefulness. Scientists call it arousal. And so right then and there, we're talking about uncertainty as synonymous or as very closely related to the signal to yourself that the status quo has ended and you need to update your understanding of the world. Mm. And in fact, a recent study that I just came across in medicine involves this benefit of the discomfort of uncertainty. A scientist at the University of Washington asked doctors after they'd finished their clinical shift about the sticky moments in their day. And what he found was that when they were uncomfortable, when something was uncertain and new, that's when their attention was heightened. That's when they began looking ahead to muster resources to cope with this new problem or situation. And so it totally underscores what the neuroscience is telling us about this good state. Uncertainty is good stress, basically. So that's a very, very important starting point.
So uncertainty is good stress, which is different from the sort of presumed threat response and fight or flight arousal of anxiety or fear.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is a different response. And, you know, when we're fearful of something, whether it's just the unknown on a daily basis, the fear of the unknown that is now seen to drive a lot of anxiety, or whether we're just, you know, going into that situation with the new, you know, whatever traffic jam or memo, if we have a fear-based response, there's an entirely different physiological systemic change in our body. Basically, our blood circulation, rather than revving us up, actually drives blood toward the core of our body, away from the extremities, including the brain. So that's the shutting down that is associated with fear. So I'm basically talking about an opening up and a waking up versus fear. And so that leads us to kind of understand very importantly that our attitudes, our approach to uncertainty are very important. So for instance, we can actually, you know, consciously, deliberately tap into the good stress of uncertainty simply by expecting that life is unpredictable. Studies in laboratories and learning in dynamic situations show that people who expect that things won't change in a highly dynamic situation are less likely to pick up on the signal of uncertainty and also the signal of the change itself. So that's kind of like walking into the morning meeting and thinking, oh, another, you know, another blah, 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 you know, nothing's going on here. And you're actually, you can see common sense shows us that that actually lowers our chances of picking up on the tension in the room or the you know, change in the boss's facial expression. You want to be stressed, as one scientist told me, when things are most unpredictable. You want to have the stress of uncertainty. It's kind of like rolling up your cognitive shirt sleeves. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the major stress hormones that's released under conditions of uncertainty is norepinephrine, which is actually related to cognitive effort. So I talk about leaning into uncertainty. And that's basically expecting that life is going to be challenging when it's a rapid change situation, rather than expecting that it's either threatening or that it's unfair that life is, you know, unpredictable. You see what I mean? It's that middle ground.
I do. And I feel like for me, the sort of closest thing to a hack in your book is really that cognitive reframe of uncertainty as something to sort of fear, dread, and avoid at all costs, versus, again, leaning into the curiosity and almost anticipation of it, which I love. But this is where my old friend anxiety comes in for me, because I think one of the challenges that I certainly see with anxious achievers is, you know, you walk into that meeting, you do anticipate uncertainty. Indeed, you anticipate disaster, bad things are going to happen. So that's sort of my question for you, is how do we turn the anxious person's anticipation of bad uncertainty into the more neutral, curious, observant framework that you're suggesting?
I think, first of all, it's important to realize that uncertainty is now being seen as a lever to treat anxiety. So just backing up a little bit, there are very interesting interventions that are targeting in a laser-focused way people's approach to uncertainty, and that are successfully lowering the anxiety, lowering their worry, lowering depression. Because as you were mentioning a minute ago, uncertainty is now seen as a sort of root vulnerability factor. So
you call it the one fear to rule them all.
Yes, exactly. According to Nicholas Carlton, a Canadian researcher. And so, you know, they talk about a transdiagnostic factor, something percolating below PTSD and OCD and anxiety and depression. And we can think of it as kind of a new lens. It doesn't, you know, erase all the incredible work that's being done on anxiety. It offers a new lens. And so another preface to getting to the practical ways we can enter that meeting in a less anxious state, the other thing that's really important to understand is that, okay, uncertainty can have this incredible, you know, spurring, provocative effect on us. It's good stress. But we also have a kind of personal comfort zone with uncertainty. Just as we might lie somewhere on the spectrum between introversion and extroversion, so too we lie somewhere on a spectrum called intolerance of uncertainty. Mm. So in a nutshell, in the simplest way possible, in this personality measurement kind of gauges whether or not you see at one end of the spectrum uncertainty as a threat, or at the other end, whether you see it as a challenge. Now, notice that I'm not saying people who are really tolerant, who just love uncertainty and cope well with it, are saying uncertainty is a picnic. It's easy street. No, it's a challenge. And that's, I think that's really important to understand, something to manage, something to work with, but not, you know, it's not that it's all cozy and comfy. It's not where the human wants to be. And so leading anxiety researchers have now been doing interventions to basically help people better tolerate uncertainty in order to lower their anxiety. So what might that look like? Well, they're basically challenging people, coaching and getting people to bite off a little more of the unknown, to put it really colloquially, to try on more of the unknown. It could be the exercises that are used in these interventions and that are working are something as simple as try a new dish at a restaurant. And, you know, at first I thought, oh, come on, you know, I really, honestly, we're talking about anxiety here. And then I began to think about how in all our lives, we yearn for the familiar and the routine, and we like to kind of hang out there. But if you say, go to the same Friday bistro and try that wonderful spaghetti that you love each week. I mean, I love doing that. We like to sit at the same seat at the dinner table at home. We love to hang out, you know, in the cozy shelter of a familiar and routine, which is not where the human being thrives and learns best. And one of the exercises that's actually used by people who are clinically diagnosed with anxiety is just delegating more work. Because uncertainty puts you at the edge of what you know. Uncertainty is basically operating at the edge, pushing forward that envelope of being comfortable. And what's really important here is that it's not that people are, you know, navigating the frontiers of uncertainty, and so therefore, their anxiety automatically lifts. It's not that they see uncertainty as absolutely 100% always wonderful. It's that they see that when they're in the unknown, there are multiple possibilities. It's not just a disaster. So they're actually learning to surprise themselves, which is curiosity and exploration.
It's not dissimilar, you know, from an exposure therapy that you might do to treat social anxiety, right? Where you might go to a party and stay, you know, for 5 minutes longer. So I think on that level, it sort of makes sense in that it's helping us expand our repertoire and get a little bit more comfortable with being uncomfortable. And then maybe we'll be surprised that it doesn't kill us.
Exactly. And you're actually, it's kind of interesting. It's a little bit, you know, neuroscience geeky, but I love the fact that what's happening here is that you're actually using the uncertainty itself. In other words, you're kind of sure that it's going to be a disaster and the boss won't like my presentation and all those sorts of things. You're trying on all of these sort of, in some ways, certainties very often. What this does is kind of enlist uncertainty, which is, scientists say, prediction error, because we constantly operate in automaticity, and uncertainty, to give it yet another sort of vocabulary for it, is not just arousal, it's an arousal because your system senses that what your assumptions and your expectations are being contradicted by reality. So there's a gap between what you assume and what you've just, you know, found out, which is there's something new out there. And so this so-called prediction error is the signal that triggers the stress response. And it's really wonderful because when you're trying new things, you are seeking prediction error. You're seeking reality checks on your own knowledge. In writing this book, whether I was interviewing surgeons and in the operating room or looking into, you know, teams that put the rovers on Mars or all sorts of different situations, I constantly found myself thinking about being jolted out of our assumptions. That's what uncertainty does in a good way.
In a good way. But a constant theme is certainty seeking and efficiency seeking and the pressures of time. One of my big takeaways throughout the book is the importance of time and spaciousness. You have a wonderful quote. I'm blanking on who said it, but that a pause isn't when nothing happens.
Yes. A Stanford neuroscientist, Vinod Menon, who studies pauses between music movements and found that the brain was most active during those tiny slices of silence than when people were actually listening to the music itself. And that study made tremendous headlines and is so almost poetic because it shows us that rest is not idleness, that pausing is not nothing. And there are two pillars of uncertainty. One is that spur, it's forward motion. It provokes us out of our automaticity, as I've been mentioning. But also uncertainty is itself a space. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of balked against the idea that uncertainty is a noun and, you know, how do you uncertaintize yourself or something? But honestly, it, you know, again and again, uncertainty is what I call wisdom in motion. It's a space for investigating a problem more deeply. So the adaptive expert, the agile expert, you know, superior experts actually spend more time assessing a new complex problem than even novices do, whether it's in finance or chess or sports or, you know, surgery, their findings across many different fields. So they're kind of admitting that this new complex problem demands some uncertainty. Mm. Well, Rebecca Solnit talks about the spaciousness of uncertainty, which is a wonderful term. So that's the second pillar of uncertainty.
But can I ask you just a, and again, I know you're not a therapist or a doctor, but you know, I think one of the things that we always talk about when we talk about anxiety is that anxiety causes you to sort of rush in with activity or answers or even just plain worrying where mm-hmm. there is space to fill. And so I found myself reading your wonderful accounts of brilliant people taking space, whether it's daydreaming, you know, enforced daydreaming or, you know, being quiet and thinking that is so hard when you have the anxious mind.
Right, exactly.
I found it very hard to square the two.
Yes, exactly. Because, I mean, if we're fearing the unknown, we want to avoid it or shut it down. And therefore, that lends itself to a rush to snap judgment. Whereas if we can inhabit uncertainty, it helps us be more attuned to what is, not what we expect or assume. And it also allows us and helps us to be in tune with what's going on at that moment, to be present to what's going on. And I call it inhabiting the question. So, for instance, the surgeon in the operating room who meets up with a problem, it's only adaptive experts who actually, as I was saying, slow down to investigate multiple possibilities within that space of uncertainty. They inhabit the question. And Dan Dwight, a CEO who got in touch with me about uncertainty in my book, said that, you know, he went into a bankrupt company a few years ago, a number of years ago, and he found that as they were trying to climb out of bankruptcy, this company was really good at fixing problems. But 6 months later, that problem would surface again because that's what they were doing, fixing as in rushing to fix right. problems. And he found that what was needed, he calls it resilience. And what it was inhabiting that question so that they could get to the root of the problem, not just constantly put Band-Aids on it. And that, in a nutshell, kind of encapsulates again what uncertainty offers us.
Yes. How can we train people to be open to the not knowing? You cite a really interesting experiment with doctors, but I'm curious, like, what can listeners take away? They may think, oh gosh, that sounds great. I'd love to be open to the not knowing. Where do I even start?
Right. I think there are many practical steps we can do personally and also with our team or the people we manage. I think, for instance, one of the, you know, the starting point is the kind of education that comes from discussions like ours. You know, it's really important to learn the new literature on uncertainty, to be open to it and not, you know, see it anymore as a weakness. The science, the studies are percolating out from medicine, from business, from all sorts of fields, you know, saying that, you know, uncertainty is not the paralysis and weakness we fear. Secondly, I think we can change our language around uncertainty. That's often a very, very important point of movement in business or culture change. So, for instance, many times I'm asked, how can I, as a leader, be uncertain, embrace the positive aspects of uncertainty, and yet not appear weak? And I think that, you know, we don't have to ride in, you know, waving the flag of uncertainty. You know, just as you've talked about so well, it's really hard to, you know, stride up on stage and announce to your team or the entire company, I'm anxious. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, I'm uncertain. I think that there are ways we can both not hide from expressing uncertainty, but broaden our vocabulary in and around uncertainty. So, for instance, we can say, you know, well, let's keep this problem open for the evening. That's really important. Also, studies show out of Harvard and elsewhere that hedge words, for instance, the use of the word maybe or sometimes, are not broadcasting weakness as we assume, but actually people who use maybe or sometimes are actually seen as highly professional. They're seen as people that others would like to work with. They're seen as being open to another's point of view. Linguistically, that's what the word maybe does. It signals two things. One, I'm open to other perspectives, maybe, instead of saying therefore or you're wrong. But it also actually indicates that there's something more to know. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. Uncertainty is important to surface and unearth and to inhabit, because then people, especially in teams and groups, can then find out what they don't know. And if you're constantly just operating with what you already know, you're not moving forward and you're certainly not being inventive. So I think our vocabulary is very, very important. And as you said, you know, as you wrote so well, you know, people prefer business leaders to never break a sweat. You know, they prefer them to look, you know, completely imperturbable, rock-like. But actually, you know, as I'm saying, you want to be stressed when things are most unpredictable in a kind of open and energetic way. And you also want people to be uncertain in positive ways. So I think we can stretch our vocabularies, we can stretch our understanding of uncertainty, and then as the clinical psychologists are teaching anxious people to do, try it on in small steps. In the group setting, you know, I think it's really important to stress that there is a social side of uncertainty, whether it's not jolting our assumptions, we're talking to someone whose politics we hate, you know, at work or across the backyard, or whether it's trying to be better collaborators at work on a team or on a group. And I think that it's really important to understand that there are ways in which we can surface uncertainty. For instance, the Mars-NASA teams that I investigated and that have been highly studied because they're so innovative used something called the listening ritual. And what all that meant was during the Mars Exploration Rover mission, which went on for many, many years, there was a standard way to end a meeting, whether it's by phone, conference call, in person, what have you. And that was to ask, is there anything else we need to know? Is there anyone who disagrees? They were seeking dissent, and they also treated disagreement, dissent, and expressions of not knowing as a positive. Instead of being seen as a jerk, they were actually welcomed. But it was that ritual, and all up and down. At one point, the rovers, someone had uploaded faulty commands, and one of these hundreds of million dollar rovers was at a risk of being lost. And so the project leaders shut down the entire mission for a weekend and sent everyone home to reflect. And then they called the first ever all hands meeting and said, we have to get back to the place of questioning where we were before. We can't lose that. That's where our success lies. And one of the sociologists who studied this mission, Janet Vertese at Princeton, told me uncertainty and also disagreement, that dynamic, that's why we're still talking about this team years and years later.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promises pay off.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
I think you're also highlighting the importance of timing, which is something we don't think about at work, because making ritual and time for uncertainty is effective. But that leads me to another question. You cite a study the Kruglansky experiment, where some respondents were shown videos that were quite traumatic of 9/11, and some were shown more banal videos. Those who had been shown the traumatic videos had less, I think, of a tolerance, which makes me think, you know, again, practically, there's a big difference between being uncertain as a leader in front of a traumatized workforce versus one that isn't in a safer space for questioning. Like, how do we balance the fact that basically a lot of our population is the equivalent of people who've just watched the 9/11 videos?
Yes, exactly. Well, what you're pointing to is very, very important to understand. And I think it can equip us to deal with uncertainty, to be less anxious. And that is to understand that the tolerance we have for uncertainty is situational. It is affected by our environment and by context. So people who are tired, people who feel pressured to give an answer, people who have information overload, all become more intolerant of uncertainty. Even if you start off pretty tolerant, you know, you're quite an explorer, et cetera, you're quite curious at work. So that's really important to understand. So if you're going through a merger, or if people have, you know, the accountants who deal with that incredible accounting season where they don't get any sleep, it's really important to understand in a kind of metacognitive view that at that point, people are going to be more anxious, if you will, or driven toward, as Kruglansky says, leaping toward an answer, any answer, any answer. So people close down because they want to get that over with. And so it's really important that uncertainty is situational as well as trait-like. And what I've been saying is that your trait or your comfort zone, your personal comfort zone with uncertainty can be shifted. You can change the dial, move the needle by constantly being open to and trying new things. But at the same time, you also can help yourself being more intolerant to uncertainty by, you know, for instance, being healthy. And in this day and age, it's really difficult. People are rushed. People are stressed. People are tired. And so at the very least, we can understand that we might be, you know, more driven to race to an answer when we're in that situation, and leaders can account for that.
I think that's really important. Yeah.
And I think one thing to add here is the second link between uncertainty and well-being, our approach to uncertainty. There's a virtuous cycle here. In other words, when we're tired or overloaded, we might want to yearn to a new answer. But at the same time, when we're more positively approaching and utilizing our uncertainty to move forward, we're actually bolstering our well-being. Hmm. And how? Well, for instance, people who are tolerant of uncertainty are going to be less anxious. One of the studies that I've talked about found that in people with GAD, generalized anxiety disorder, one of the most intractable forms of anxiety to treat, when they were treated in a 12-week therapy program, one-on-one therapy hours to bolster their tolerance of uncertainty, their worry levels fell to about the same as the general population. That's stunning.
That's amazing.
It is. More work needs to be done, but this is gold standard, randomized controlled studies, et cetera. Now, the second link, which is really interesting and important, is through curiosity. And a lot of people ask me about curiosity and uncertainty because they sense there's some kind of parallel, or their cousins as human states. And it's true. One of the most important pillars of the curious persona, people who are highly curious, is that they are much more likely to tolerate the stress of the unknown. So they're more likely to tolerate the discomfort, the awkwardness part of being operating in uncertainty.
Why? Do we know why?
Well, it's because they're actually the kind of curious people who are acting on their curiosity. So you can be curious and you can kind of wonder, oh, what's the name of that painter, or who won the Super Bowl in X? But, you know, actually, unless you're willing to tolerate the stress of uncertainty, you often won't act on it. So it's really related to being the one who raises their hand with a dissenting remark in the workplace. It's related to people who are willing to tolerate the stress of the unknown at work, are curious, and they're also more engaged at work. You know, they're just on their toes. And The other interesting point is that this facet of curiosity is the most highly related to well-being. So these are people who seek the uncomfortable. They read difficult books. They raise their hand to say, I disagree. I mean, you think, wow, that sounds really stressful. But actually, what's happening is that when you can be open to all of life, the negative, the difficult, the threatening even, and actually operate in that milieu at the edge of the unknown, you're open to both the good and the bad in life. You're not hiding or closing down. People who are highly curious and who can tolerate the stress of the unknown are more likely to have more pleasurable moments in life. They have higher life satisfaction. So, you know, again, life isn't a picnic just because you're curious and, you know, sometimes awkwardly so. But these are the type of people who are rated by family and friends as being better able to manage uncertainty. So there's a sort of package of skill sets here that shows me that it's a virtual cycle when you can kind of lift yourself away from the fear of the unknown and understand that when you can admit that life is difficult and unpredictable and mutable and doesn't always go your way, then you're actually able to contend with all of life.
Is this a temperamental thing? Are people born differently? Can you learn it? Is it about your privilege also in the world and where you come from?
Oh, yes. Great questions. Well, I think that, yes, the personality disposition related to tolerance or intolerance of uncertainty is intrinsic, innate to us. So, you know, as I'm mentioning, you have a certain comfort zone.
Right.
But again, it's changeable. You can expand your tolerance of uncertainty as interventions are showing. In fact, in the medical world, people are exploring teaching doctors to better tolerate uncertainty in order to curb overdiagnosis and overtesting. Because the de facto sort of yearning in medicine is to reach for that test to try to attain more certainty or to label something that maybe is murky and ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
But it's costly. I mean, it's both traumatic for people and it's a huge expense in the medical field to constantly have this testing, which isn't useful and sometimes leads to unnecessary treatments. So this is a huge issue right now in medicine to try to, again, use intolerance of uncertainty to perhaps allow doctors to be more able to contend with the unknown. And it's interesting because I talked to doctors in one particular program in Maine. These were family physicians in their residency, so young doctors, and the faculty had become very, very concerned about the young doctor's discomfort with uncertainty. As one of the young doctors told me, I just wanted everything to be straight out of the textbook.
And, don't we all? You know, don't we all?
Yes, exactly. And you know, how did they move the dial? Because the faculty created a successful kind of intervention, a program to help bolster their tolerance of ambiguity and uncertainty. And what they did was include more time for reflection. So that spaciousness, that pausing, that ability to not just run with the first answer, which is often off base and, you know, usually based on what you know in the past. So you want to be able to reconsider something as murky and complex. They also explicitly put uncertainty on the table and told the young doctors, it's okay not to know. Well, isn't that something all leaders and managers can do? To say, instead of coming expecting the outcome-oriented meeting, which is very, very, very popular, everybody comes in with an answer, so we battle it out, and you know, we leave with an answer. But you know, when we can allow ourselves just, I'm talking about a few minutes sometimes, to say openly, I don't know, let's work on that, then mm-hmm. you know, we really gain. And what was unbelievable to me, which was so amazing to me, was that at the end of the program, both the faculty and the young doctors told me that this ability to tolerate and contend with uncertainty, heightened ability to tolerate uncertainty, had given them courage. There's another word
wow.
that we don't think of as being synonymous with. And why? Because basically, as one program leader told me, uncertainty allows you to consider and reconsider and so strengthen your ability to contend with the next problem. It gave them courage. They were building their skills through the use of uncertainty, because uncertainty is a vehicle, it's not the end route. And I thought it was wonderful because the great psychologist, philosopher William James talks in one of his huge volumes about the courage of a maybe. He says, no act of faithfulness, no great deed is undone without the courage of a maybe.
It does feel very brave to be a maybe, especially, you know, in a place that isn't psychologically safe, mm-hmm. when the messages that we get are just to be efficient and solve things. I want to go to one of my favorite examples in the book that I did send to my kids. Talk about using cue words and trying to be open to uncertainty, even while you're in the process of trying to achieve an outcome that you really, really care about.
That's really important. And I think a very liberated new understanding of uncertainty and stress and its relationship. You know, a lot of the time through the dopamine circuits, we often talk about ourselves as reward-based people, that we are going through life seeking reward, and that's how we learn, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, it's kind of a narrow view of how we operate. And in fact, it underlies a lot of how AI is built. And that's another problem in another podcast. But in any case, I think we so often worry about the outcome. If you're giving a speech or you're having a sports game, culturally and maybe individually, we think about that score, or we think about whether we'll triumph at the end of that speech. And what that does, while it's very important, I mean, we need to move through life operating on attaining rewards because that's part of moving forward. But at the same time, it takes us away from the present moment in a way that's really corrosive. Just for one example, there's a study that showed a mega analysis of professional tennis tournaments. And I mean, at the top, you know, Wimbledon and the US Open tournaments. And they found that if the trophy was displayed on the court during a finals match, the best player on the court, the one who was expected to win, faltered. He struggled. It was that reward-based outcome. They didn't lose the game more, but they were struggling through it. And so it's called reward-based distraction in psychology. So how do we push back on that? Well, what we want to do is be able to inhabit the uncertainty. We don't know the answer. So we're kind of dragging ourselves down if we're focused on the answer, when the whole reason that we need process is to get to an answer. So what about process? Well, what you want to do is restore the ability to be in the situation to its fullest, to have those curious eyes, as I mentioned. And one researcher, Jeremy Jameson, has been working with people in very stressful, challenging situations, you know, such as a law school exams or a presentation in front of, you know, judges. And he found that just briefly telling people that this stress of the unknown that they're dealing with in these challenging situations is actually equipping us to do better. So there again, we're realizing that uncertainty is good stress. What happened when he coached people on this in a very few minutes was in actual real life situations, they became more engaged with what was going on around them. They were able to pick up on things. And so I think that's a really important way that we can dial back on test anxiety or that sort of anxiousness, and we can kind of liberate ourselves.
What are the cues? I know that there were actual verbal cues. Could you give us an example of one?
Yes. Well, a cue word is a wonderful reminder of the fact that we can engage with the present moment in a less anxious way. For instance, sometimes young athletes are taught to quote unquote focus on every play. So they develop their own mantra. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can say to yourself, focus, this is a little bit different, but when I'm trying to fall asleep and my mind is racing, 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 I just tell myself off duty. You're off duty. And it's just, I think I was inspired by this idea of the cue words. So when I'm in the present moment, I can say to myself, on duty. But if I'm off duty, you know, try to allow yourself to draw the line and to, you know, then step away from that constant racing mind, worrying about outcome, basically.
Maggie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Our show is produced and edited by Mary Du. Our assistant producer and sound engineer is Nick Krinko. Many thanks to the LinkedIn Presents family and to all our guests for sharing their stories. If you love the show, tell your friends. I would love you to leave a review because they really matter in helping the show get found. You could also follow us or subscribe. If you have a question for me or you want to submit an idea for the show, find me on LinkedIn, where you can follow me, message me, I promise I'll write back, or subscribe to my newsletter for more from the anxious achiever world. Thanks for listening.